Welcome to Unit 9. This is still Christian Leaders Institute and Practical Mathematics. And today we're going to look at least common multiple, greatest common divisors, and economics as well. So, what are these strange things here? The least common multiple of A and B is the smallest number that both A and B will divide. The greatest common divisor of A and B is the largest number that will divide both A and B. So very closely related if you think about it. So let's start by finding the greatest common divisor of A and B. So you pick two numbers that you've got to get the greatest common divisor for, A and B. Doesn't matter which one of them is larger, but for convenience sake, let's just say A is bigger than B, okay? You divide B into A, and you get a remainder. We'll call it R1. So, now you divide R1 into B. Now, if R1 is 0, B is the greatest common divisor of the two. B divides A just fine. If it's not 0, you divide R1 into B, and you get another remainder, R2. Now, R2 may be 0. It may be something other than 0. If R2 is 0, R1 is your greatest common divisor. If not, then you divide R2 into R1, getting R3, R3 into R2, etc., until you get a remainder of 0. Whatever the last actual number you get is, whatever the remainder is that occurs right before the remainder of 0, will be the greatest common divisor of A and B. Sounds simple. Now, the least common multiple of A and B is A times B divided by the greatest common divisor of the two of them. Don't worry about the math, I'm leading you straight. Now, if you want the greatest common divisor of a bunch of numbers, okay, say 5 or 6 or n numbers, you start by getting the greatest common divisor of the first pair. Then you take that greatest common divisor and get it with the next number, getting the greatest common divisor, then the next number, then the next number, then the next number, all the way through until you get the remainder of 0 for the last of the however many numbers you have, n numbers. That would be the remainder, and that's the greatest common divisor is gn minus 1, the last one you come up with. Now, if you want the least common multiple of a big batch of numbers, you find the greatest common divisor of the entire set of numbers, and then you multiply all the numbers together and divide them by greatest common divisor to the n minus first power, and you get the least common multiple. This is starting to sound a little bit weird. It isn't really. Let's move forward and take a concrete example. Hot dogs and hot dog buns. Now in this country, you get 10 hot dogs to a package. Why is that? That's about a pound of hot dogs, and they sell these things by the pound. Unfortunately, it's 8 buns to a package. That's about a pound of hot dog buns. So you want to have enough hot dogs for one hot dog for every bun, and enough buns for one bun to every hot dog. How do you do that? You need the least common multiple of 8 and 10. So first you find the greatest common divisor of 8 and 10. You divide 10 by 8, you get 1, and the remainder is 2. Okay, now let's go back and divide 2 into 8. We get 4 with no remainder. Great, we have our greatest common divisor of 8 and 10, that's 2. So we want the least common multiple, that's 10 times 8. We divide that by 2 and get 40. So 8 divides 40, 10 divides 40. We're in good shape here. So we need 4 packages of hot dogs and 5 packages of buns. That'll give us 40 complete hot dog in a bun servings. Does this sound a little contrived? Maybe. But it's a reality that we live with out in my world. Now, frankly, in my family, we'd either, you know, eat the extra couple hot dogs without the bun, or if we had extra buns, we just toast the buns up and make cinnamon toast out of them. But let's assume that wasn't the case, and you need to get 40 buns. So, let's go visit the taco shop, okay? We've got the opportunity. We can make a contract to buy a large amount of everything, and they'll deliver it a little at a time. So, we want a contract to buy enough to make some large number of tacos and have just the right amount to do the whole game with all of the tacos and not have any leftovers or any significant amount of them. So we need the greatest common denominator of all the ingredients. Hamburger makes 6 tacos per pound. Taco shells, you get a dozen tacos. A head of lettuce will do 12 tacos. Tomatoes, they'll do 32 tacos per pound. Onions, a pound will make 14 tacos. And then you've got the taco seasoning, which will go for 1 pound of hamburger, that's 6 tacos. So we've got the 6, the 12, which shows up twice, 32 tacos, so that's 6, 12, 32, and 14 are the numbers we've got the greatest problem with here. So we need the greatest common divisor of all of those so we can compute the least common multiple and then figure out what we're going to order. So here we are. Here's the problem set up. The greatest common denominator of 6 and 12, it's 6. 6 and 14, greatest common denominator is obviously 2. And of course, 2 and 32 is still 2. So the least common multiple is 6 times 12 times 14 times 32 divided by 2 cubed, which is 8. That comes out at 2016. So you need to buy the ingredients for 2016 tacos. And again, you'll be contracting to get them delivered a little at a time. So this is what you're going to be buying. 336 pounds of hamburger, the same number of packages of taco seasoning, 168 packages of taco shells, 168 heads of lettuce, 63 pounds of tomatoes, and 144 pounds of onions. Right. But it illustrates how you use this, how you do the computation, and how it could be useful in planning out ordering, in this case tacos. There's no doubt other things that you could be looking at that you might want to order enough to do just enough for all of however many. It's simple, and it's actually useful. Now, so much for the math. Let's move on to things that are a little bit more abstruse, but still somewhat mathematical. Let's look at economics. And let's do some basic definitions here. First of all, what's economics? It's the study of how a society takes the limited resources that it has to satisfy the needs and wants of its population. Now, resources are undoubtedly limited. There's only so many dollars. There's only so much wheat that gets grown. There's only so many cattle that are raised, so many hogs, chickens. There's only so much cheese and eggs, and everybody's got to eat. And there's other things, cars, clothes, fuel, etc. Economics is a study of how this stuff not only gets allocated, but to whom it gets allocated. So, what are needs? The things we've got to have to survive. You know what those things are. Food, water, shelter, etc. Wants? Well, it's things that would be kind of nice to have. We could survive without them. but we still would like to have them. Those are wants. Now, obviously, in any economy, it is incredibly important to meet the actual needs of the members of the economy. Whatever the society is, people have to have food, shelter, water, etc. They have to have their needs met. Ideally, in a good economy, the society will also find ways to meet, well, maybe not all of their wants. In fact, ideally, not necessarily all of the wants, but at least as many of the wants as they can, as fully as they can. This is what economics studies, how that's done. So, some more basic definitions. Land. Everybody looks at land, yeah, I know what it is, but it's all the natural resources that are used to produce goods and services. That would include the crops. That would include minerals extracted from the land, rent paid for the use of the land. Perhaps you rent this land out for grazing. Perhaps you rent it out for people to do other things with, do recreational four-wheeling or whatever. Whatever. That's all scraped together in the category called land. Goods are tangible things bought. Pizzas, automobiles, houses, towels, shoes, scissors. You get the point. Durable goods are things that are bought, but they last for a long period of time. So that would be cars, refrigerators, washers, dryers. Those are there. On the whole, when they're talking about goods, they're talking more about perishable stuff, things that you'll use up, paper, kind of wear out those shoes, etc. Non-durable goods are things that are bought and consumed. Fuel, pizza, shoes, towels, okay? You're going to wear it out. You're going to eat it up. You're going to burn it like gasoline. And then services are things, either deeds, actions, whatever, that one person or group do for another person or group, like cutting my hair, wiring my house, delivering me a pizza. Okay, those are services. Some more basic definitions. Labor is the human effort expended either to make the goods or provide the services. So, people in the factory, they're making the goods we use. Teachers and medical personnel, we're providing services if we're teachers and medical personnel. We're educating you or your children. We are taking care of you when you're ill or preventing you from getting ill. That's a service. All of that is, however, labor. We all have to expend effort to do it. Capital, that's whatever your resources are used to produce the goods. Now, that would be the machinery to make the goods or that are used to perform the services. The vehicles that transport the goods to here and from there, or the people providing the service, the building used for manufacture, the nice factory that's built in, the store that you sell stuff from, you know, buildings where services are provided, that is the actual capital that you've got to deal with. Useful definitions. I'm just giving them to you as think points. Okay, so let's move forward with economics. And there are some key questions that any economy has to address, answer, think through. First of all, what goods and services should be produced? How many goods? What amount of services are going to be produced? And again, you have to realize there's a limiting factor as to how many can be produced. You've got only so many resources to deal with. And every worker that you put into providing services is a worker that's not going to be providing goods. Every ton of steel you use to make cars is a ton of steel you're not using to make, say, train tracks or girders for buildings. So you have to start thinking, how is this going to be allocated? The workers are finite in number. The resources for the work to use, the workers have to have something to build it with. How are you going to do that? Those are very important questions in the economy. Okay, how are we going to make the stuff? That sounds like a silly question, but it's not really. There's an engineering that goes into this, but you know, are we going to make them in a factory here? Are we going to make them in a factory there? Are we going to have people just doing it in their homes? You know, are we just going to call up the guy down the street and ask him if he's willing to rake our leaves for $20? You see what I mean? How is this going to be done? And here's the big one. Who gets to consume the goods and the services that are produced and provided? Anybody who wants them? Do we want to allow people who are, in some sense, considered more important, who provide something unique that is very desirable, maybe we ought to let them access more goods and services? You're starting to see where it's coming from. So how is this all addressed? Okay? How you answer those questions defines what kind of economy you have. And it doesn't matter what kind of economy you have to answer those questions. So what are the goals of your basic economy? One of them is the economy wants to be efficient. Now in this concept, we're not necessarily looking at how efficiently you produce the goods and services, but we're looking at getting the biggest bang for your buck, so to speak, getting the most amount of satisfaction of people in the society as a whole, given the limited resources that you have. So you're not looking at one single person's satisfaction. You're looking at the satisfaction of an entire population. It's not a single person so much when you're planning the economy or when the economy's functioning. It's everyone. It's tens of thousands of people, possibly millions or more. That's what you're looking at in terms of efficiency. How well do we get the whole population satisfied? Will everybody be completely satisfied? Okay, look, let's not kid ourselves. There are some people out there that you will never satisfy. And there are some people out there who are content and thankful for just barely enough to get by, and you can satisfy them easily. Starting to sound a little more complicated than it looks. I grant you that it is. But again, when you're looking at an entire society, tens of thousands of people, yeah, it cleans up a little bit. You want to look at growth. Okay? Economies want to expand their ability to produce goods and services. Yes, they have limited resources in terms of manpower. They have limited resources in terms of raw materials and recyclable materials. But they want to use what they have. Maybe they want to increase the number of people able to work. Maybe they want to increase the number of raw materials they have to work with. Maybe the way it's going to grow is become more rapid and efficient in their use. Hey, maybe growth is going to happen because we do a much better job recycling the steel, the aluminum, the other metals, the paper, the plastics. But either way, the goal in doing that is to expand the goods and services available, because for most people, the more goods and services they can afford to access, they can manage to access, the more likely they are to be satisfied. Security and stability. Okay, I think we've all seen situations where suddenly the prices of something skyrockets, or suddenly employment bottoms out. There's a sudden disaster in production, and things go wild. One of the goals of an economy, an intelligently planned economy, is to try to achieve some degree of security, reasonably stable wages, reasonably stable prices, reasonably stable employment, reasonably stable production of goods and services, because if people are confident that they will be able to have predictable income, that income is going to stay reasonably stable and probably grow over time, they'll feel secure. Especially if they know that that pound of hamburger is going to cost pretty close to the same amount as it does now in 3 or 4 years. And as the price of hamburger may grow, my income's going to grow with it. So I'll still be able to feed my family. We need people in the economy to feel secure, again, or they won't feel satisfied. We need to achieve equity as well. Now, equity is one of those unfortunate little things. There are two completely different meanings for it, and we really want to achieve both. Obviously, the first one is fairness of distribution of the goods and services produced. People get their just share. On the other hand, we also talk about equity in the sense of the things owned by individuals. So when you borrow money on a house, as you pay that money back, you own more and more of the house, you're building the equity. You're owning more of the house, so you're building your equity in that house. As prices of houses around you rise, the value of your house rises. You've got increased equity. So it's unfortunate that we chose to do it that way, but we want to achieve both of those things. People having increasing equity and people having fair distribution of the goods and services. And of course, we want people to have freedom to decide. How will they be involved in providing goods and services? We want them to have some freedom in being able to decide what goods and services they will choose to consume, and from whom they will choose to consume them, perhaps if there are multiple suppliers. You get the drift. So, with all of those things in mind, and again, these are all things that different economies solve differently. Let's go to the whole concept of kinds of freedom, kinds of economies. Now, your traditional approach to economies, the ones that are traditions-based, have the access to jobs, to goods, and services essentially determined by exactly that tradition. And it's often personal demographics. The nobility at one time in feudal Europe had access to great amounts of education, art, food, clothing. The serfs, they didn't have that kind of access. They worked the land. They had access to the tools they need, and often it was because they made them themselves. But the barons, the lords, the royalty, that personal demographic got them stuff. The caste system in India, you have the Brahmins. They're kind of the Brahma are the top of the heap. And then you've got the pariah down at the bottom. And you're going to be born into what you are to a great degree when the caste system still was major in India. Other things, poorly paid jobs at one time limited the access of goods and services, and it was mostly women and minorities that got the really rotten jobs that nobody really wanted or that didn't pay well. And of course, the lack of money tended to impair their access to the goods and services. So the tradition structure can work in a number of different ways. Okay, you can also have an economy that is market controlled. You go out and you find the best job you can. and you keep your eyes open to see if you can get a better job down the road. Increase your skills, increase your education, increase your ability, increase your reputation. Maybe you can get out there and get a better job. More money. That allows you to get more goods and services. Conversely, the price of the goods and services will be, to a great degree, controlled by the demand for them. If everybody wants this latest kind of shoes, and the production is only so much, and the ability to supply this desired item is a lot less than the ability to demand it. People want them. Everybody wants them. They can only produce a handful of them. People will pay more for it just so that they're the ones that get it. On the other hand, you know, it's been a great year. You know, there's 10 tons of grain out there. I mean, the granaries are overflowing. They want to get this grain out of there. People are going to say, no, I don't want to pay that higher price. I want to pay a lower price. So market economies, very dynamic, somewhat unstable, but the marketplace, that's what decides how much your labor is going to be worth. That's what decides how much that good or service being provided is going to cost. And then you have the central economies. Those tend to be a central authority that says we're going to produce this many toothbrushes, we're going to produce this much toothpaste, we're going to make this many pizzas, we're going to make this many cars, we're going to... Everything is decided by some controlling body that runs the whole show. These are the people we'll let buy cars. These are the people that we're going to give the nicest shirts to. The not-so-cool shirts you guys over here are going to get. You see the point. So those are your basic flavors of economies, the ones that are based on tradition, that are driven by the market, and that are driven by a central controlling authority. Now, all economies are mixed economies. There's almost always one that is dominating over the other ones. And that's going to be driven by necessities. Wartime economies, for instance. You know, when a country's at war, the government pretty much is going to be the central control thing. Everything's focused on getting that combat won. Goods and services are going to flow in a way that the government decides to make sure that the, well, war is won. Now, America's economy is almost completely a market economy. Now, there's still some traditional aspects. We've still got some minorities, and, you know, ladies have a tendency to be paid less as well. But that's dwindling over time. In my lifetime, I've seen that dramatically drop. And there's a great deal of central control as well. Costs of medical services now are increasingly defined by the U.S. government. So it's growing as well, but we're still mainly a market economy. The price of a car, the price of a pizza, the price of a pair of shoes, a lot of that's going to be determined by supply and demand, which is your basic market economy. Now, the economy in China, that's not completely central, but it's mostly a centralized economy. But the market portion of the economy, that's growing. One of the things they've discovered is that if they're going to motivate people to do more, they're going to be rewarded more. You're going to have a bit of a market economy for that. And again, as is true of most places, there is a traditional element as well, perhaps more pronounced in China than it is in other places. So, a couple of points. The central economies, and this was implied earlier, are best suited to wartime economies. And again, if you're in the middle of a disaster, you're dealing with a huge famine, you're dealing with an earthquake, something like that, a more central structure, that's going to be very efficient. But outside of those unusual circumstances, it doesn't function well. And here's why. If you're a central economy and you're planning it out, you've got to outguess not only the future needs of the population, what their future wants, and you've got to outguess what your resources in terms of both raw materials and labor are going to look like over the year. You practically have to be able to predict the future accurately. So there's some difficulty with that one. Now, traditional economies are incredibly stable, but the equality of access to employment, to different kinds of employment, the quality of ability to improve your status in life, it's very poor. It keeps individuals very often from rising to their full potential, and poor performers can be born into or be put into positions of power, large ability to control all kinds of decisions about who gets what, how much they get, and those poor performers are locked in positions of power, and there's no way to dislodge them. So, yeah, they're stable, but they got their problems too. Now, a market economy tends to be incredibly effective and efficient in terms of distributing goods and services. I mean, you get out there, and if you can earn the money to get it, you can get it. If you can save that kind of money, help yourself. The trouble is that market economies are unstable. Well, they're not all unstable, not all the time, but they're easily pushed into instability. Here in the United States, COVID-19 has caused, as I lecture today, some distortions in our market economy. Face masks, hand sanitizer. I mean, the price of that's gone through the roof. There was a big issue. There were a lot of people in the meatpacking industry that came down with COVID-19, which was related to vagaries of how the meatpacking industry puts its workers almost cheek to jowl in the meatpacking building. A lot of those went out. Suddenly, price of meat went up because, I mean, there's plenty of animals to be made into meat, but there was nobody to do it. So it was hard to get meat products for a while. Prices went sky high. You get the point. There can be considerable instability. And it can go the other way as well. Prices can suddenly drop. Prices for labor can suddenly drop. When there's a lot of unemployment, for instance, people will work for less just to have a job. You get it. Okay? Now, one thing you have to understand is there is no one of these approaches that is always the best for an entire economy. You know, there's just some things where a degree of central control is going to work well. Supply of water. Processing wastewater. Okay. Some areas, the market economy really works best. Supply and demand in terms of food, toys, clothes, it's not such a bad thing, especially as fads come in and go out. Not a bad idea. Okay, traditional, even it has its values, although I can't really tell you what they are. And frankly, as I was hinting there, some sectors of economy may work out better in this way. Other sectors, they maybe need to be handled by that way. So it's not fair to say this is the absolute best way of handling things. And frankly, over time, the answer that worked at one point in time may be a poor answer at a later point in time. The instabilities in Europe at one time in history, drove the formation of the traditional economy with the nobility and the serfs. That was a way that the world was so unstable. They needed that stability. And that's what built that. Over time, that became a problem, and things moved towards more of a market economy. Again, during World War I, World War II, most world economies, at least the U.S. economy, became almost totally central. But then it went back to market as soon as the war was over. So it's not a simple thing, but at least you've got the thinking points now where you can look at an economy, understand more clearly what's going on. Of course, if you can do that, it gives you a better shot at being able to figure out where you can fit into it and how you can support yourself and your family, how you can proceed with your ministry, how you can do things more effectively, knowing how it works. Well, so much for Unit 9, and I'll look forward to sharing with you what there is to learn in Unit 10.